Hey everyone, this is Martin Willis with the Antique Auction Podcast, and I'm here with Malcolm Gutter in San Francisco, his wonderful home in San Francisco. How are you doing, Malcolm?
Fine.
Good.
Eager,
yes. Now, as I just said, a wonderful home in San Francisco. There's beautiful antique furniture in here, just wonderful pieces, and a lot of ceramics, but a lot of your ceramics are not here.
That's correct. They're at the San Francisco International Airport Museum, ready to be put on exhibition starting the 1st of April.
The 1st of April, and running until?
Running until the 30th of September 2010.
Aha. So I'm walking through here and I see all these display cases and everything that they're
yes,
fancy.
They're all bare. The cupboard is bare.
Yeah.
I feel like old Mother Hubbard. Is that what it is?
But I see signs. I see little plate racks and things here and there.
It looks like
you've been robbed or something.
Yes, that's right, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So if they come back, there'll be nothing for them to take.
Right. This is a good time to... If you're going to get robbed, this is a good time to get robbed, right? Phyllis is not here today. I'm just here with Malcolm. She couldn't make it. She actually has to work. So I feel bad for her. But anyway... So I met Malcolm about 2 or 3 years ago, and we were discussing porcelains and meissen, and that's one of your specialties, isn't it?
It is my specialty. It's more than that. I live and breathe it.
Meissen?
Meissen. Uh-huh. Early meissen porcelain.
And how long have you been collecting meissen in particular?
I'm ashamed to admit it, because people used to come into the house after I was collecting about three or four years and asked me how long I've been collecting, and I told them, and they had their eyes open, because by that time I had acquired a few good pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can say I've been collecting 30 years.
Have you really? Wow.
Yes.
Wow, that was 30 years ago was a good time to be collecting my stuff.
I came into collecting meissen porcelain at the end of what I call the Golden Age, when there were many dealers dealing in continental porcelain in the United States, even in San Francisco, and especially in New York, and they are all gone.
Wow.
And there was still a lot of early meissen, both to be acquired by dealers and private collectors, and there were a number of very important private collections in the country, and now there are very, very few.
Now, when you say they're all gone, you mean like...
The porcelain has, for the most part, been sold at auction or through private treaty and has gone back to Europe. And
really?
A considerable number of pieces have gone into European and American museums.
Yeah, I was wondering about the museums.
And the result is that there is relatively little meissen of what I collect left in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it meissen figures also you collect?
No, I don't collect figures. When I first started to collect, I didn't have a focus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part, of course, the excitement and education of collecting, of being able to discriminate and to discern as to what one really appreciates and loves to acquire, and things that are just of lesser interest. And I began to collect a few figures when I first started. But it wasn't more than about the first 5 years, and I began to realize that collecting figures was just not as interesting for me as collecting the service wares, which is what I do exclusively and have been doing for the last many years.
Well, I see you're not totally wiped out. I'm looking on the wall behind you, and I'll probably get a picture of you and post it on our podcast site, but I do see some nice... meissen pieces on your wall, hanging on your wall there.
Right.
So you were able to keep a couple of pieces not in the exhibition.
Well, as a matter of fact, there are only two pieces of meissen on the wall.
Okay. Wow.
One on the right is a Ludwigsburg plate that I acquired in Butterfield's basement on Sutter Street many, many years ago when I began to collect. Then my only piece of English Chelsea porcelain.
Wow.
A dish from about 1755, Red Anchor, is on there.
Third one over?
That's the third one over. And then on the extreme left side is a what I consider a late Meissen plate, soup plate, from about 1765. Again, one of my very first pieces. Now, the two Kylan, Kakiaman style Meissen plate, again, one of my very first pieces, which I deem very unimportant now, and any of the pieces of Meissen that I don't think have the seriousness and importance and rarity of the things that I've been collecting for the last 20 years or so. None of those pieces are in the exhibition.
I see. I see. Let's take a little step backwards. What sparked your initial, not in Meissen in general, but and I always ask this question, what sparked your interest in antiques in general?
Yes. I have a rather provocative belief that collectors have certain genes, and they are born with these genes, and these genes are acquisitive genes. And I must have several of them, because okay. I've been collecting since I was about 5 years old.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
I've always collected something. I used to collect baseball cards. I collected comic books. I collected movie star cards. Hmm. And then by 11 years old, I was collecting postage stamps. And in fact, I think I learned more from my postage stamp collecting than I did from my schooling. So I've always had this acquisitive penchant. And in the 1970s, as part of my economics teaching at Foothill College, I took a sabbatical leave. I went to Dresden, and I was told that I could go to Meissen on my way to Poland, and I was frustrated in not being able to buy a souvenir from the manufactory because I was leaving the country. I didn't have East marks left, and I only had West marks or American dollars. They would not accept this currency. They only accepted East marks, and I didn't want to go into Meissen town, the town of Meissen, to change money. And instead, I decided I would buy my souvenir in Warsaw, Poland, which I did. And that was the spark of my collecting Meissen. The frustration of not being able to buy a souvenir at the Meissen manufactory.
So you started on a resentment, basically.
Well, I don't know if it was resentment, but it just was a gap in my ability to satisfy this urge to have a souvenir. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Now there was another facet, and that is that while I was a graduate student at Berkeley, I had befriended a man who was a Jewish refugee who had been brought up in Chemnitz, which was then called Karl Marxstadt at the time, during the communist era, and who had brought over his family heirlooms of Meissen porcelain, which, of course, today, it's not very early, but nevertheless, he just obsessed with Meissen, and Meissen and Meissen. And so while I was getting my visa to go into East Germany, in London, I asked the travel agent whether or not I could go to Meissen on my way to Poland. And he says, yes, it's with the visa allows you to do that because it's within the environs of Dresden, and your visa specifies that you will be allowed to go to Dresden. And so that's how I got to Meissen. I wanted to go to Meissen, hence my frustration in not buying a souvenir. And then when I had my few souvenirs that I got in Warsaw, and then I went to Munich with my brother, I came back and started to read about it, and I began to realize it was a very serious academic endeavor. And being frustrated with economics as a profession, I began to learn more about not only Meissen, but also decorative arts in general. And that led me to take a sabbatical, another sabbatical leave in subsequent year to go to London to study at one of the institutes in London that taught decorative arts.
Wow, that's a nice place to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So while we're going to get into the decorative arts a little bit later, but why don't you just tell us what you know about the Meissen factory in the early beginnings? And
the Meissen is celebrating its tercentenary this year, 2010.
Wow.
It was founded in 1710 by decree of Augustus the Strong of Saxony. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he was Elector of Saxony and King of Poland. And he needed to generate revenue for his kingdom. And he decreed that various establishments be made to cultivate exports from Saxony, including a porcelain factory. And this was established in the Albrechtsburg fortress in the town of Meissen. The ability to make porcelain had just been discovered 2 years before, or 1 year before, by Johann Friedrich Bethge.
Now, was this the clays near there?
The clays were found in and around the Erzgebirge, which are called the Saxon Alps, and it's these mountains are very rich in ores, and the mining had been undertaken from the Middle Ages, and for example, Saxony was very rich in tin. And also in silver. And the miners knew where these ores are, and Bethger was able to find the necessary clays in that area to produce this porcelain after a 2 years or so of experimentation with various clays. He succeeded with a man by the name of Walter von Tschernhaus, who died in 1709. And because Tschernhaus died before the final formula was developed, Bethger is given the credit for discovering the ability to make the porcelain.
Wow. Now, are the very first pieces of Meissen very plain, or are they...
No, from a... It's amazing. From the very first steps, the porcelain, as well as his red stoneware, which was discovered a year before and which was only produced for 5 years until 1713, these wares were subject to wonderful decoration and design by the court silversmith, by pieces they had copied from the Asian imports of particularly China, and from soapstone models, from serpentine forms. All of these things were copied in the red stoneware and then in the white porcelain. And so from a very early period, they produced some very elaborate and beautifully, beautifully modeled wares and very sophisticated.
Wow. Now, were there markings at that point?
No, there were basically no markings on either the red stoneware or the white porcelain until the early 1720s.
Okay.
So that very early red stoneware produced at Meissen and white porcelain produced at Meissen are unmarked, except in the case of the red stoneware, one might find some former's marks, but nothing of what we consider the famous marks of Meissen, such as the blue cross swords mark. That didn't start until 1723, in fact.
Uh-huh. Do these early pieces ever come up?
Yes, but they're not. They don't come up very often here in the United States, except it used to be in New York, but even in New York you don't find that many at Christie's and Sotheby's, for example. Mm-hmm. But they do come up in London, and they'll come up sometimes in Paris, and in some of the German auction houses as well.
Must be a lot of demand for something like that.
Yes. Especially when the wares are of some rarity, rather than just ordinary cups and saucers, they'll command a very, very high price, especially the red stoneware, which is especially sought after because it is very rare.
Now, when you were collecting Meissen, did you collect a lot of it in Europe, or did you...
Most of the pieces that I have acquired have been acquired in Europe, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I was very fortunate this past summer of 2009 to acquire 6 pieces, and that was just by the such incredible good fortune that they simply appeared and I was able to afford them.
Mm-hmm. Afford them, yeah, that's... Now, speaking of affording something, do you know what a high auction record is? People always want to know. Of any Meissen, the type of things that you collect.
There was a Meissen harlequin figure that sold for hammer price £400,000.
My God.
In December of 2007. And so it then, with the premiums, came to about $1 million.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
And this was a Kendler harlequin figure. The sale was at Christie's. And as I say, it was December 2007. And it was a one-owner sale. One of his harlequins brought £400,000. The subsequent harlequin of a different model brought £300,000.
Wow.
And so this gives you an idea of
that's amazing.
How high these pieces can bring. And important vases can bring, or rare teapots can bring, 100 to 200,000 pounds.
Wow. And these are breakable things.
Very breakable, yes.
That's the thing.
But you know, excuse me,
no.
But so are Chinese porcelains.
Sure.
And Chinese porcelains can bring millions of dollars.
Right.
And they just care for them.
That's right. I heard of this situation years ago. My father was telling me back in the 80s and maybe early 90s that there was a pair of really important Chinese porcelains. I can't remember if they're vases or probably vases. He said one was... one was in perfect condition, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, it brought $200,000, which was, to me, was the highest I'd ever heard of anything like that. And he said the other one was identical, but it had a crack in it, you know, hairline crack, and it brought $20,000.
Yes. Well, yes, condition is very important in the collection of ceramics, but more and more people are finding and changing their attitude. They're finding that a very rare or unique piece will be the only time they'll be able to acquire a piece like that.
Mm-hmm.
And even though there might be some damage to it, it's still a very beautiful piece. Mm-hmm. And they will be, they are willing to overlook the damage, especially if it's slight damage, in favor of the rarity and beauty of it. Mm-hmm. I must be completely candid about this. I find that condition is a of unimportance for my collecting, mm-hmm. compared to a piece's rarity and beauty. Mm-hmm. And that if a piece is rare, beautiful, I think that I after a while, just like a person with personality flaws, you mm-hmm. begin to overlook it.
Hopefully, yeah. You know, I've always liked, for some reason, I really like the old staple repairs.
Yes,
I think
yes.
they're actually
they're
really
charming,
interesting.
Aren't they?
Yeah.
Yes.
And I wouldn't mind owning a
like
piece
that.
With staple repairs.
Yes, yes, yes. They're very, very nice. Although I acquired a wonderful Meissen bowl taken from a Japanese Karkiamen prototype a few years ago with a staple repair, but because I found that the repair disfigured the actual appearance of the piece in a way that I found disconcerting. Mm-hmm. I had my restorer in London remove the staples mm-hmm. and clean the piece, and now the piece is really beautiful as without mm-hmm. any of the that late 19th century staple repair, which undoubtedly was done in England.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But when someone does repair, let's just say a charger, and there's a crack in a charger, and you know how you can flick it with your finger, it has that funk
yes.
sound. Now, when they repair it, does it still have that funk?
No, it doesn't. I find that repairs today can be done with such finesse mm-hmm. that all of the disconcerting personalities mm-hmm. that come from a piece that's been damaged disappear, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. including an ugly thud when mm-hmm. you flick it.
Right. Mm-hmm. I was in a house doing an appraisal a few weeks ago, and there was this beautiful, it was a ceramic, Chinese ceramic urn, covered urn, and there was a pair of them, and they're pretty monumental pieces and early. And one looked perfectly fine, and the other one, there was something about it that I didn't like. And then I realized, after really examining it closely, that it was repaired. Say for the novice collector, is there anything he or she should be looking for to not buy something that was repaired?
Well, as I say, if the piece is rare and beautiful, I don't think there's anything wrong in acquiring something that is repaired. Mm-hmm. And I practice what I preach. I'll buy a piece on that basis. Mm-hmm. There's one thing in acquiring a piece that's been restored or damaged. The other question involves knowing that a piece has been damaged and restored. I think that is very important. A person should acquire a piece with his or her eyes wide open, mm-hmm. and that includes condition. And as long as the condition is known and then accepted, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Now, of course, the same piece that is in perfect condition will not bring as much and have as much value as a piece that has been damaged. Nevertheless, just the fact that a piece has been damaged, I don't think should be the kiss of death. I myself acquired a pair of vases, early Meissen vases, this past June in Paris. And the pieces, the vases are so beautiful, and they are so incredibly rare and important, that the fact that they both of them were damaged for me and for the friends with whom I'm sharing them with, we feel that this is just a minor factor. And I may add that it's very possible that if these vases, and probable, that if these vases were in very, very, very good condition, we wouldn't have been able to acquire them.
Good point.
We would have had so much competition that it would have been impossible. And I would far rather have a Venus de Milo without an arm than to have something which has been coming out of a much less, as a grade of work of art, but in perfect condition. In fact, I have a little philosophy. I think a collector that has nothing but perfect pieces will have a collection of mediocre pieces.
I like that. Very interesting.
I think that a collection that has great pieces will inevitably have pieces that have been damaged. And when one goes into the great museums of the world, one sees a lot of damaged pieces. And I've never heard of anybody says, oh, it can't be beautiful, it's so damaged.
Yeah.
Right? No one ever says that when one goes to the Metropolitan or the Louvre or the Victoria and Albert Museum, right?
You know, I actually, I got to say I like that attitude. I really do. Because I've been, as an appraiser and everything, I've always had the attitude, oh, it's damaged, you know, it's not, you know, and take away from it completely. And it's like, it makes total sense. If it's a very rare thing, where are you going to find it?
Right, exactly. As in, okay, you don't like this? Well, have them make me another one. Well, of course, they're not going to make another because they don't make them anymore.
Right.
But there. But that said, it's accepting damage on a piece is a relative thing. It must be relative. Something where there's there'll be another piece that you've seen that comes down the pike at maybe 6 months or year or 3 years and 4 years, and you think you'll be able to have a chance to acquire a piece in better condition. Fine, then let something that's damaged go. But if something you feel is really very, very rare, and you will not have an opportunity to acquire it again, then I think that you'd be foolish not to grab it and when you can.
Excellent. Good.
And also hope that your competition is snobbish enough not to have that very, very great wisdom that one does.
Yeah.
Now, furniture, on the other hand, I find that one shouldn't accept, for example, on a chest of drawers, a replaced feet.
Yes. Now, that's a good point you just brought up, and I want to talk a little bit about that. And my feeling is, on that whole subject, is that I think it's more forgiving in California than it is on the East Coast.
Yes, it is. It is. And probably because there is less of it. There's less good furniture, for example, early furniture, old furniture in California than there is on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And therefore, people are more forgiving of condition. Condition problems.
I remember, I don't know if you read through the Maine Antiques Digest, but years ago, back in like 1987, I think it was, there was a time capsule, a home that was sealed up for almost 100 years, I guess, from generation to generation. And in it, there was a rare flat-top highboy that was in perfect condition because it had been sitting in this dark house that was all covered. And a friend of mine bought it back there. And for $80,000, which at the time was a record.
This is at auction.
Yes, came up at auction. And there was an academic that was at the auction, and he was writing a book on Queen Anne and Queen Anne furniture, and he started a rumor that there was a replaced drawer, a drawer front replaced. So it went back and forth between the Maine Antiques Digest, and finally they had an analysis done of the wood and ended up being right. And so But the antique dealer who bought it, the friend of mine who bought it, was pretty upset about it because...
In other words, your friend allowed some, quote, expert, unquote, tell him not to buy the piece because there was something wrong about it?
No, that's not it. What he did was my friend bought it, and then an article came out afterwards saying, well, that was a lot of money considering the door front was replaced. And there was controversy. It went on for about 6 months. It was pretty interesting.
No, in the long run, I think one has to be one's own expert. And if one starts to listen to so-called others and others' opinions, there's nothing wrong with taking their opinions into advisement, but one, when it comes to the bottom line, one should be able to buy, and one should be able to buy with confidence in one's own judgment. And that doesn't mean that we don't all make mistakes. We all do. But I think that one must develop knowledge in one's field so that one has enough confidence to either say yes or no.
I've had an interesting experience here in California, selling a piece at an auction and then having the dealer, antique dealer, coming up to me and say, was that a good buy? Is that thing okay? After they bought it. And it's like, I was pretty amazed. But I see those are wonderful knife boxes you have there.
Right.
Over here. Is,
right. A pair of...
Yeah, those are English, are they?
English knife boxes.
Those are beautiful.
Late 18th century.
Yeah.
Right. They have a very good color on them.
Yes.
Exactly.
So right. Now you taught decorative arts as well as ceramics.
Wait, yes.
Before we get way off of ceramics, you were involved in the ceramic circle?
Yes. I'm on the board of the San Francisco Ceramic Circle, and I'm very happy to give a plug to it.
Yes.
And the club has been in existence since 1972. So we're going on 30 years, and we're dedicated to educating people in appreciation of ceramics and the beauty of ceramics. We are officially an associate of the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. We meet on a monthly basis at the Palace of the Legion of Honor in San Francisco, and we welcome any new members.
Okay, now is there a website or any information online?
Yes, the San Francisco Ceramic Circle has a website, and it's just very easy to find it on Google. I don't know exactly what the
WWWs
are, but...
Yeah, WWs. I'm going to put a link of it up on the website on my links page.
Oh, that would be just terrific.
So that'll be there.
Just terrific. We have speakers every month, and they're on diverse topics in ceramics, in both in terms of material and in span of time.
Yes, and you and I are both members of the American Decorative Arts Forum.
Correct.
And that meets once a month also.
Right.
And I already have a link of theirs up on my website.
Great, and so that San Francisco Ceramic Circle would love to have new members, and one can visit at any time any of our meetings, and hopefully then they will join. And we used to meet on Thursday evenings. Now we meet on Sunday mornings at 10 o'clock, as I say, in the Legion of Honor.
Now, just bouncing back a little bit to ceramics and collecting meissen, are you aware of any younger people? I'm always thinking about demographics and collecting.
Yes.
Are you aware of any younger people at all collecting meissen?
This is the great, great tragedy, especially in the United States, but also to some degree in Europe. As in the United States especially, they just died out. Collecting meissen porcelain was a passion for European immigrants into the United States after the Second World War. And there were many of them not only who collected, but also who dealt in meissen and other continental porcelain. they were able to get their collections out before the Nazis confiscated a lot of things. And after the war, people who came over were able to bring their collections out. And that's how so much of it came into the country. And there were many collectors of it. Mm-hmm. And these people now have died off. And so there are very few young people who have taken their place. This is a great tragedy.
I have hopes that there's going to be somehow in connecting younger people to collecting these wonderful things.
Yes, but this is true. This is true in collecting antiques in general.
Sure.
Everyone cries the blues about younger people who develop a taste for antique objects.
Mm-hmm. I put our podcast on Twitter, and I was looking through different people that, say museum people and antique shops and things like that. And actually, I was kind of surprised. I actually found quite a few younger people on there.
That is so just great. And when I go to Europe, we do find that there are some young people who have generated a great interest and passion in ceramics. I'm thinking of one person in particular who is English, and he's in his early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And my God, he has so much love for ceramics in general, and he's very knowledgeable.
Well, here's my feeling on this. As time goes by, people are going to collect it again because look at what's being made today and
yes,
look what was made then.
That's right.
You know?
What's being made today is just so awful.
For the most part.
So I hope you're right, Martin.
Yeah, I do too. Let's talk a little bit about the decorative arts. So that's another segment of your collecting and your teaching. Now, when you say decorative arts, that's a real wide range.
My course covered architecture, because I think architecture is the basis mm-hmm. of decorative arts. And then I spent a good half of my course on furniture,
mm-hmm.
French furniture, Italian furniture, English furniture, and American furniture. And then metalwork, especially
mm-hmm.
silver,
mm-hmm.
and then ceramics. And at Foothill, I covered textiles, especially Oriental rugs.
Wow, boy, that's
so. It was quite a job. And
yeah, I mean that's real intense. There's a lot to know in those fields.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. You can tell. That's why I wanted to do this podcast with you, because you can tell when someone's passionate about
mm-hmm. thanks very much
about this thing.
Right.
And I think we're going to have to end on this high note, as we are. And it's been, I mean, I could go on for another hour or two.
As well as I can.
I had that feeling. But anyway, this is Martin Willis with the Antique Auction Podcast with Malcolm Gutter in San Francisco. And we're both signing off.